drawn and forgotten. Every piece of comedy, a stand-up set, a homemade sketch, a cartoon drawing, or a notebook of ideas, all that which lives on some abandoned corner of the internet or in some cardboard box, it will probably never be seen. It's what makes it special. It's a piece of personal history. Back in the early 2000s, I was in a bit of a rut. I had just had a kid, the shit eater, and I was essentially out of work, except for a few acting roles here and there. At this point, with my girlfriend Amy's help, I came up with a concept for a TV show, a late-night talk show for kids called Midnight Pajama Jam. The goal would be to air the show around 8:30 or 9, around the time young kids go to bed, and make it like their version of The Tonight Show, except with absurdist guests. An artist friend of mine made two puppets, a purple octopus and an eagle, and I tapped comedian John Glazer to play the sidekicks. Except, instead of puppeteering, he would just hold the two puppets up on his fingers and do the voices for both, unconcealed to the audience. The eagle, named Lumpy, had a gravelly tough voice and said, "Rawr!" a lot. And on the index finger of the other hand was the octopus named Scott Fellers, who had an effete accent, like Gore Vidal if he were an interior decorator. The dynamic was that Lumpy and Scott Fellers disliked each other very much and would openly bicker all the time. As far as guests, we would come up with characters, a mix of random oddballs who would do traditional interview segments but improvised based on an outline of some particular comedy conceit. It was a bit Pee-wee's Playhouse-ish in that it completely ripped off Pee-wee's Playhouse. We first set out to do a live test of the show in a small theater in Midtown in the afternoon to cater to an audience of mostly kids. We had a house band and three guests. One of the guests was a character called Pitstain. He was a fictional neighbor who would drop by the show uninvited and tell mundane stories, with his hands always raised behind the back of his head, exposing the namesake Pitstains. Next was a segment called Vanity Plate, in which two guests who ostensibly had the same vanity plates on their respective cars come on. The plates read HOT-STF, Hot Stuff. The man had it because he thought he was attractive, and the woman had it because she owned a bakery. Everything in the show went fairly smoothly until we presented a guest called Wyatt Trash, which was a bit where the actor Matt Walsh, dressed in overalls, sang a song with a southern twang, with lyrics that went as follows. I'm white trash, I'll kick your ass, I fucked your best friend's wife, eat a can of beans, drive to New Orleans, now I'll try and suck my own dick. Then he dove on the floor and awkwardly and with great effort tried to contort his body to give himself oral sex. I don't know how we felt that this was okay, but it was, in retrospect, a glaring oversight bordering on child abuse. The upside was that most or all of the kids were too young to decipher what was happening and just laughed hard at a man writhing wildly on the floor without context. The problem was that the parents were not children and understood very clearly the context. So it was a bit of a moral conundrum. In hindsight, it was a show that adults and kids could enjoy together as long as the kids didn't understand Dotto Fellatio. As we developed the show, we phased out the kid angle and adapted it to be more strictly for adults, but kept the puppets and the loose, wacky concept. This involved losing the full band and replacing it with my friend Gary behind a keyboard in a C-3PO mask who'd mimic playing John Williams' theme from Star Wars as the CD was played over the sound system. We would still bring out fake guests with different comedy concepts and kept the improvisational nature of the show. The odd thing about a failed venture is that while you're working on it, you have no idea it's failing. I think we all thought at the time that we were on the cusp of something. At the onset, the show was exciting to do, despite audiences that topped off at about 10. When there are more people in the cast than in the audience, it makes for an odd dynamic. We initially performed the show at midnight at the original UCB Theater in New York City. The first show there had about 8 people in the audience, and our guest musical act was the Trachtenberg Family Slideshow Players, who were a real family musical group, mother, father, and daughter, who wrote songs based on slides they found at estate sales, which they projected behind them when they sang. The daughter, who played drums, was around 8. Gary, our C-3PO mask bandleader, had taken acid that first night and got it in his head that the mother and the father were holding the daughter captive and making her play drums against her will. So during their performance, he tried to stop them by sticking his head through the curtain and trying to get the daughter's attention so he could free her from playing. Fortunately, he never ran out and grabbed her. I guess, even on acid, he was respectful of boundaries. When we started to do the show weekly, we performed it at the UCB Theater in Chelsea, right around the time it had moved there from its original location. That theater had about 100 seats and had taken over the space from a small repertory theater. The most interesting shows were the ones where the audience, for our show, was split between a smattering of friends and then a few older couples who thought they'd be seeing a show staged by the previous repertory theater and never checked that the theater had changed to an improv comedy venue. I'm not certain which I enjoyed more, the disdain from children's parents or the disdain from confused old folks wondering why they were there seeing Wyatt Trash and not Hedda Gabler. Although, there were parallel Freudian themes. As we kept doing the show, our audience didn't exactly swell. It more just smoldered. Typically, with this kind of project, you see some returns for your efforts as word of mouth would start to spread and audiences would start growing in size. I'm not saying there wasn't incremental progress, but on the whole, most shows were not well attended. But this wasn't exactly unfamiliar territory. Once, when I was in a sketch troupe in Boston called Cross Comedy, we came to New York City to do a run at a Midtown Black Box theater, and the first show's audience consisted solely of my aunt. Literally, only my very Jewish Aunt Marion, sitting at a front row table, basically touching the stage. The rest of the room was empty. We noticed this only moments before the show because we were all in the green room, and then one of the members of the group went to check out the crowd and returned to say, "You all will want to see this." When we discovered the empty theater, but for the older woman in the front, and I recognized that older woman as my Aunt Marion, I begged them to consider canceling. But we were rehearsing for an industry show to present to television executives, so the rest of the group insisted on doing it. The comedian Dave Attell was the warm-up act, and he had to go out and do 10 minutes of stand-up exclusively for my aunt, who, by the time we started our show, was eating a Reuben sandwich with a glass of red wine at her table. After the show, she said stolidly in her very Jewish voice,
"I like the comedian."
So, not only did we just perform only for my aunt, but she ended up not even liking it. So yes, I'd had some experience with dismally attended shows. Sometimes in comedy or any other endeavor, self-promoted and self-sustained, just sticking around is half the battle. So many unbelievably funny people dropped out of doing comedy simply because it's a zero-sum game at a certain point. I just happened to be lazy enough not to get out of it. Basically, I hung around long enough. But Midnight Pajama Jam was wearing out its welcome, so John Glazer and I did the natural thing and decided to gather enough money to make a DVD despite strong public disinterest. It was like the producer's scheme, except everybody, including us, would lose money. I got donations from friends and family, and we staged a show taped at a small theater called The Marquee in downtown New York City. The show went well. We had Matt Walsh back as Wyatt Trash. The comedy duo Sloven and Allen came on portraying two fundamentalist pastors who travel the country warning kids of the evils of pornography from the back of a van. Also, Eugene Merman came on dressed in period costume as a gay hunter, in the spirit of Van Helsing, but instead of vampires, he hunted gay people. Also, comedian Sam Cedar, who happened to have really huge and muscular calves in real life, held up a curtain with his back to the audience and set a spotlight toward the bottom of it, and as music came on, raised the curtain to reveal his oiled-down calves like some fetish striptease. If nothing else, we finally captured the essence of a show that we had worked on for the better part of 3 years. It was a bit of a mess, but it was a creative, ambitious mess. And the taping gave us hope that we could sell the show to television so we could get a bigger audience on board. That would pay back our small investors, my sister Jody, and put us in a position to achieve bigger goals. We couldn't wait to get to editing the footage we had. In fact, our editor, Bill Buckendorf, called the next day and told me to come over to his apartment as soon as I could. Apparently, he was as excited as I was to get this show together. Bill did all the videos for Midnight Pajama Jam. He lived in the East Village on St. Mark's in a 6-story walk-up, so I was never excited to go over there to edit, but knowing we had done a good show overshadowed my hatred of climbing 6 flights of stairs. I got there and sat down at his desk in his small bedroom where he edited. He looked a bit sheepish, as if something was wrong. I asked if he was all right. He gestured to the monitor and said that I should see for myself. He played down the raw footage of the show's opening, and there was no sound, so I told him to turn it up. He said, "It is up. There's no sound."
"On the whole thing?"
"No, not the whole thing. Oh, thank God. The sound kicks in at the very end."
"At the very end of all the footage?"
"Yeah."
"Fuck!"
Bill said, "I think the sound guy forgot to press record until the very end of the show." After all this, our record of the Midnight Pajama Jam show is basically a silent movie until I come out to say goodnight to the audience. I suppose it was a poetic climax to a show that maybe was never meant to be, and a testament to the idea that some of the best memories are the times leading up to the grandest failures. I'm sure that's how the guys at Enron felt, but in our case, all we did along the way was lose money. We were poor, but happy. Well, not exactly happy. My failed business ideas. John Benjamin's 911. Instead of calling 911 directly, call me first and let me be the first voice you hear in an emergency situation. I will assess, take notes, and listen to every detail, and then immediately pass on your info to the real 911. Despite taking a little extra time in a potentially time-sensitive crisis, it will be worth your while to be comforted by the molassesy smooth tones of my rich and soothingly soulful voice. White coffee. The most expensive coffee in the world is called Kopi Luwak. It is coffee that has been collected after being eaten and digested, then expelled, as in shit out, by the civet, a wild cat indigenous to Indonesia. It sounds disgusting, but supposedly it adds to the richness and complexity of the taste. It costs around $50 a cup. My concept is based on the Indonesian model, but Americanize it. Take standard beans, have American-born white children eat them, digest them, and shit them out, then process them to make white coffee. The difference in taste and pride and the even more unusual production process really puts this cup above all the others. Based on the small batch of white children used to make white coffee, the cost of the cup would be around $250. Slidoos. Shoes that slide. Slidoos are shoes with specifically designed carbon fiber sheets attached under them to make walking less leg-intensive. Most of walking involves lifting the legs, but Slidoos change all that by adjusting the design. With Slidoos, you shuffle and slide more and walk less, expending less energy and creating more fun. Sliding is more fun than walking. It always has been. And Slidoos are built to slide. How many people out there would rather slide to work every day than walk? I bet a lot. Think back to when you were a kid. One of the best things to do after a big snowstorm was to get up early, go out, and slide on the ice. Slidoos lets you do this at any time, anywhere, and in any weather. The big chair. Do you remember the feeling you had when you were a child? When everything seemed wondrous and new, when you were carefree and filled with endless optimism, when you sat in a chair and let your feet dangle above the ground? Well, you can experience all those feelings again with the big chair. The big chair is a regular chair designed 30% bigger to scale than a standard-sized chair, so your feet can dangle, giving you the sensation of being young again. The big chair is an immediate mood elevator and a natural relaxant. After a hard day at work or a hard day at home with the kids, sitting in a chair that's a little too big for you will make all the difference. Sometimes you just need to feel smaller to feel better. Leftovers, the restaurant. Food waste has always been a major issue at restaurants, and sometimes people eat less than half the food brought to them. Leftovers is a great place to eat, and a great place to eat cheaply. Here's how it works. All leftover meals can be ordered at full price. But for people not queasy about sharing strangers' food, Leftovers provides the ability to order the remainders of other people's meals. Let's take, for example, our chicken parmesan dinner, with ziti and marinara on the side, priced at $16.95. That's a big plate of parm. At Leftovers, depending on how much of it you have eaten, you may bid out your uneaten portion to another guest who can buy it at a reduced price based on the amount of food left over. It's sharing at a reasonable cost. And Leftovers essentially pays you back for not eating, as long as you can find another hungry customer who's not squeamish about hygiene. So, your $16.95 chicken parm just got down to $8 after you sell your Leftovers and so on. With that, based on what you can bid out to others, your meal's cost goes down commensurate to what you've paid forward. Leftovers. It's a way to eat what you want and not feel bad about leaving what you don't. Cool shades. Sunglasses have always been at the forefront of cool. Cool shades are sunglasses you can put on anything to make it cooler, not just on your face. Cool shades are custom sized according to your specific needs, depending on exactly what you want to make look cooler. Put them on your dog, and you've got a cool dog. Put them on your lamp, and you've got a cool lamp. Put them on the tank of your toilet, and you've got a cool toilet. Put them on the front of your car, and you've got a cool car. Even put them on the casket at your grandpa's funeral, and you've got a cool funeral. On anything, anywhere, cool shades make it cool. Laos Grove, a unique resort adventure, luxury with a twist. Vacations are becoming more and more specific. These days, you can plan a trip around very particular interests like yoga, vegan cooking, glamorous camping, water sports, even as micro-focused as martini resorts that cater to those who want a completely immersive experience in learning about and drinking martinis. I have come up with a resort experience that has appeal for those travelers whose spirit of adventure draws them in a different, more unique direction. Here is the brochure. Elegant accommodations. Retreat to your finely appointed room or suite with a tropics, garden, pool, ocean, or oceanfront view. Each features a spacious living area, a full bathroom with a jacuzzi, your own furnished terrace or balcony, a complimentary minibar, and more. World-class spa. Treat yourself to dozens of pampering choices in the Laos Spa. Experience pure indulgence through a combination of the latest hydrotherapy and indigenous treatments. Then, grab a workout in our state-of-the-art fitness center. Gourmet dining. Indulge in an expansive array of international cuisines. Dine out at one of our a la carte gourmet restaurants, where reservations are never required. Enjoy fine wines, beers, and other top-shelf spirits in any of our bars, lounges, and restaurants. You can even order your favorite cocktail poolside or on the beach. Weddings. Make your fairy tale wedding come true at Laos. Choose from three romantic wedding packages, each featuring free anniversary nights. Our professional wedding coordinator can handle every detail so you can focus on each other. Kill your father. Laos Grove will customize a hunt to create a memorable experience for you and your family. Our professional staff will help coordinate, plan, and oversee the entire process so you can enjoy the singular rewards of this most special of occasions. As we say, we do the work. You just kill your father. Chapter 20. How I failed to have a Chinese dinner while visiting my parents in Arizona. My parents, after their retirement, moved to Arizona for the winters. Traditionally, Jewish retirees, snowbirds, would get a place in Florida, but my parents went against the grain. They decided on Tucson. It is a nice city. temperate in the winter and surrounded by mountains with an extensive network of desert walking trails in the foothills. My father and mother liked to hike, so for them, this was the perfect spot. I did not inherit their love of walking. I abhor a walk. Well, I wouldn't totally say that, but I definitely resent a walk. I am conflicted. I'm sure I inherited the will to walk from them, but I am fighting that will at every turn. And I hate turning. In fact, the rejection of my parents' traits has been a prominent part of my identity. My father is an active guy. Even when I was a kid, he was always doing something, whether it be home improvement work, some outside project, exercise, etc. As I remember him then, he was never at rest, constantly in motion. And my mother was a professional dancer, so the always-in-motion attribute similarly applied. As my parents aged, this perpetual movement didn't end. Even when they bought a winter condo in New Hampshire for respite, there was never a sense of stillness. My father even started to build a stone wall running from the condo down a forested hill. Stone by stone, he stacked a 3-foot wall. Not for any purpose, like keeping out interlopers or marking a property line, just a random wall in the woods whose end was indeterminate. An eternal wall. It was like a Greek myth. "What are you doing, Father?" "Building a wall." "Why?" "To build a wall." Me, I like a good long sit. I think I developed that while watching them. I could watch someone work all day. I have an unquenchable thirst for apathy. That creates some tension between me and my parents, who may prefer their son work hard in their image. But I do enjoy my trips to Tucson. It's time to sit back, tense up, and be with family. In 2006, the third year I was to visit them there, I received a phone call from my mother. She was excited for my trip, and knowing that I had become something of a food lover during my time living in New York City, she told me they were excited to take me to a new restaurant they discovered. Now, before I get into this any further, I should explain that these trips to Arizona almost exclusively revolved around food. Yes, there was the hiking and the walking, but mainly the day began and progressed with planning and coordination and the discussion of dinner. Where, when, for the restaurants they had been to, a detailed accounting of prior meals there, how they've changed, or how the quality fluctuates. And scheduling, the careful and critical precision that goes into deciding when to leave in order to make the reservation on time, or slightly before, depending on whether there would be a drink at the bar. Nothing is left to chance. Discussion of lunch plans runs concurrent with the day-long, extended conversation about the upcoming dinner plans. So, as you can imagine, there were 1 to 2 balls in the air at all times. There is a small, elite collection of choices of places to eat, all curated over time by my parents. There are maybe 5 to 7 restaurants that they go to, and while the rotation may change, on every visit, like clockwork, we would hit each spot. On occasion, there would be talk about switching it up, but on the whole, my parents are creatures of habit. Oh, and also, they like dining out, but are a little less particular about the quality of food than your average refined diner. They are more into ambiance, and really overcooked chicken. I know it's a trope, but if memory serves, there hasn't been an order of chicken that isn't sent back to be cooked a little more, please. Cooked a little more, please, should be the name of a restaurant for old people. But when my mother called, she was quick to highlight that the place she and my father had discovered was a Chinese restaurant. She knows I love Chinese food, and during my time in New York City, I had spent a great deal of time discovering the best under-the-radar places in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. My interest was immediately piqued because I hadn't thought of Tucson as having a large Asian community, let alone a real Chinese food scene. Still, she reassured me that this place was remarkable. A real gem in the rough. With that, I was on board. Any city in any locale can sprout a real gem in the rough type place, so I was into it. A few days later, I received another call from her, and again, she mentioned the gem in the rough, as they had eaten there the night before, and she repeated how amped up they were about introducing me to this place. So authentic. So now, for accounting purposes, 2 mentions of the phrase gem in the rough, which hadn't bothered me prior to the first phone call, but after the second was now my least favorite phrase. Before my flight, there was a third call, with a last-minute mention that we would eat at the Gem in the Rough the first night I arrived. So, to summarize, my parents were off the charts excited to impress me with this new hidden treasure with some of the best, most authentic Chinese food in the Southwest. I arrived in Tucson, took the obligatory hike, and promptly at 6 o'clock, we piled into the car to finally see what all the fuss was about. We drove for a while through a pretty remote part of North Tucson until, finally, we turned a corner, where from the back seat I had a clear view of a long street and up ahead in the distance, a massive 30-foot cheesy pagoda gate with horses, and on top, a sign lit up, P.F. Chang's. To its right, a massive parking lot with a warehouse-sized restaurant, and next to that, a Lowe's or some big box store. I almost swallowed my tongue. I think I even uttered a barely audible squeal. But at this point, I'm not sure whether this was the place they've been touting, or if there's still a shot we drive by it and continue on to the Gem in the Rough. "There it is," my mom said. Pregnant pause. "P.F. Chang's?"
"Yep."
"Oh."
"It's delicious."
"But it's P.F. Chang's."
"Yeah."
"I mean, I know it. I just figured you guys were saying it was some secret little spot." Then my dad, "What do you mean you know it? It's a local Tucson place." Dark clouds were gathering. "I mean, no, Dad, P.F. Chang's is a big chain." Then my dad slowed the car down and craned around. "No, it is not." This was declarative, not interrogative. "Dad, there's a 30-foot sign, and the restaurant is the size of an airplane hangar. This is not a Gem in the Rough. There's hundreds of P.F. Chang's. There's a few right outside New York City." And my dad again, slowly.
"You are mistaken."
"I'm not. Trust me." Then him again, gravely.
"This is the only P.F. Chang's."
Now, at this point, it probably would have paid to be diplomatic, or at least employ some level of restraint. I knew he wanted to believe that P.F. Chang's was some personal discovery, but... "Dad, you're very wrong. P.F. Chang's is basically a fast food Chinese chain, with probably thousands of locations all over the place. When we go in, I'll ask the non-Chinese hostess for the map of all the locations." He went ashen. Fury. Silent fury filled the car. He jammed into a parking space and got out, with a look like if he could, he would wrap his hands around my neck and squeeze till I told him with a crushed larynx that there was only one P.F. Chang's and that he and my mother found it and, pointing at the restaurant, that was it. We took the short, dead man walking walk into the restaurant in deafening silence. When we entered, it was your typical monster-sized P.F. Chang's, with not a single Asian employee, right down to the teenage white hostess I had predicted. "Excuse me, do you have a map of your locations nationwide?" I couldn't resist.
"We do."
She reached under her hostess station and pulled one out. It was a map with, like, 500 red dots all over the country. My dad was seething. "Table for three, please." We ate our meal without much talking. I had the lo mein. It was decent. My dad had the humble kung pao. For the remainder of the trip, my dad was embittered by what is now referred to as Chang Gate, not to be confused with the actual Chang Gate in front of most P.F. Chang's, that huge entrance gate that people pass through on their way to a really large Chinese chain restaurant with hundreds of locations all across the country. To this day, we can't eat at P.F. Chang's without the sting of that moment rearing up, that moment when a father and a son faced off in epic struggle over truth, pride, and a side of oversteamed rice. If you ever happen to be in the Tucson area, or the Birmingham area, or the Huntsville area, or the West Des Moines area, or the Little Rock area, or the Burbank area, or the El Segundo area, or the Atlanta Airport area, or any number of other areas, you may want to check out this little gem in the rough called P.F. Chang's. Take your parents, even though they may see you as a curse on their very existence. Chapter 21. The Flood A Waste of Waters Ruthlessly, or How I Failed My Rental Car. If you don't know who I am by now, my main claim to fame is voicing the character Bob on the animated show Bob's Burgers, and voicing Archer on the show Archer. These are two very popular animated shows on television, and being a cast member on them has been a big part of my life for the last 10 years. At this point, my animated children are essentially the same age as my real-life one. The shows have been a big part of my life and hugely beneficial. First, because being an actor, at least prior to these jobs, was very up and down work-wise, and since these shows have been on the air for a long time, I have some job security. And second, because voiceover work makes for a very easy schedule. Unlike regular television acting, voice work is time-efficient for the actors. There's no hurry up and wait. An episode of an animated show takes the actors only a few hours to record, as opposed to a live-action show where one episode can take at least a week. I record both shows a few miles from my apartment and occasionally receive free tea from the cafe across from the studio just because my nasally voice is regularly on TV. Normal voices have to pay for tea. Voice work was never a goal of mine when I was a young comedian. As a matter of fact, I never even really knew about how or why people did it when I auditioned for my first animated show in a pantry of a guy's kitchen in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he had hung a microphone in front of shelves of canned goods. This wasn't some Disney soundstage. It was more like voiceover porn. I remember feeling dirty afterward, but that was more a product of having to perform oral sex on him for the job. That's kind of how it works in the voice game. The first show I worked on, Dr. Katz Professional Therapist, the one I auditioned for in a closet, was a collaboration between the comedian Jonathan Katz and a science teacher turned software developer named Tom Snyder, who created an innovative way to make a comedy show involving very cheaply produced animation and comedians recording their acts, with Katz portraying a therapist and chiming in. It was essentially comedians using their routines as a fake therapy session. I played the cartoon therapist's lazy son. From this part, I started a career in voice work and quickly learned that I was singularly unsuited for the basic parameters of the job, which mainly consist of the ability to perform multiple voices. I can perform about two. Unless I'm forced, in which case I can do an old Jewish man voice and an old man from Maine voice. But my career was reared in a world where it was more important not to pay extra talent, so I flourished. Tom's company used a lot of non-talent to do voices because it was more convenient than casting. Some voices in shows like Home Movies were people who worked in the company, the guy from shipping, for example, as opposed to actors. There were definitely a few times where I was asked to play a character that would have been dramatically better if a real voice actor was called in, but I was there. I often get asked how to get into voice work, and I usually say the best way forward is just get another job, and hopefully someone will be producing an animated show nearby, and they'll ask you to do a voice. When I was cast to do the voice of Archer, I worked a whole season of the show without meeting a fellow cast member or the creators who cast me. This is not uncommon in voice work, wherein you record from anywhere with the directors on the phone filling in for the other actors. So it's basically a puzzle piece in the process. This is conversely not how it works on Bob's Burgers, because the actors perform together more like live action, all in the same recording booth, or via headphones if the other actor is in another city. But for Archer, there was a world where I would never meet any other people connected to the show, if not for publicity events. Now, let me point out that publicity is my least favorite part of being on a television show, but it's also an integral part of the work. I guess all the shows I worked on that preceded Archer and Bob's Burgers, like Lucy the Daughter of the Devil and the Dick and Paula Celebrity Special, were so under the radar that normal avenues of publicity were never taken, so I was not exactly prepared for talking about the shows I was in. After one season of Archer, I was invited to participate in an annual publicity event put on by the Television Critics Association, the TCA Awards. It takes place over a two-week period in a resort in Pasadena, California, and all the new shows and existing shows are presented for the television critics via Q&As with the show's stars and creators. Each network gets a day to feature their shows, while the entertainment reporters sit in sequestration for 2 weeks, eating catered food and rolling in and out of consciousness while sitting from panel to panel. I'd actually done this one time before for the show Home Movies, and as I remember, the reporters used our panel as a pee break, as in, when we took the stage, they left en masse, so we presented to a nearly empty room. When I received the call to attend the event in support of Archer, I declined. A few minutes later, I got a call reminding me that I was the voice of Archer, so I needed to be there. I was actually on vacation in Gloucester, Massachusetts at the time, so this was already an imposition, but I reluctantly agreed. They do fly cast members first class, and to be honest, I had not traveled first class that much, so it was something of an incentive. I think that was one of the selling points for going. They'll fly you first class. First class is very enticing, you know? Imagine if the army flew everyone first class. So many more people would enlist. The military should at least offer an upgrade to people who'd pay. I went to Logan Airport in Boston and boarded my flight, settling into my first class seat, with an occasional guilty glance back through the veiled curtain to the hardscrabble confines of coach. I'll have the filet mignon, I told the flight attendant. After my meal, I enjoyed copious amounts of Cabernet Sauvignon and polished off an ice cream sundae. I disembarked with a first-class smile and a nod to the flight attendant while chewing on my complimentary mint, looking forward to a bright and prosperous future ahead. Now, for the failure portion of the story. I had taken the last flight out to maximize my vacation time, so I got in very late to LAX, and when I went to collect my rental car, I had forgotten that it was a pretty long drive to Pasadena. I upgraded to a midsize and I hit the road. It was around midnight. Now, for context, I declined the GPS, so I was basically winging it. Pasadena is about an hour-long drive from the LA airport. As I was on the main highway north, the exit I was to take was unexpectedly closed for repairs, so I was stuck on the highway with no idea how to get to Pasadena. So I decided to take surface roads to figure it out. After 5 minutes off the highway, it hit me. A deep-set, bubbling gurgle from the upper stomach moved like a rotating fist into my lower bowels. A gusher. I clenched up knowing what was forthcoming. Fucking filet mignon in first class. The situation was progressing quickly, so I drove feverishly to the nearest gas station, slid out of my car as stiff as a paddleboard, and did an ass-clenched hop to the pay window. Bathroom? No bathroom. Please, I'm sick. No bathroom. Fuck! More hopping back to the car. I slid back in and drove with my ass off the seat till I found another gas station nearby. Sweaty and white as a ghost, I did the clenched hop to another gas station attendant and got the same result. So, now with greater urgency, I shuffled back to the car for some much-needed strategizing. My walk was more of a sway, like a waltz performed by a marionette. Every ounce of energy was being put toward holding in the fetid contents of my first-class meal inside my anus. So this was the moment of truth. The moment when I had to decide whether to go to the bathroom in a garbage can or on somebody's lawn. I drove slowly, scoping out lawns that had enough cover to sit and have diarrhea on them for an indeterminate length of time. I was also in some serious distress, but not enough to consider the important issues. What happens after? What happens after I have diarrhea on a lawn for 20 minutes? What is the process by which I clean up? I would have to use my clothes. Now the decision in my very confused physiological state was between knocking on someone's door or giving all my effort to hold the diarrhea at bay till Pasadena and driving as fast as I could. I was now around Fairfax and Melrose, around 40 minutes from Pasadena. I went with the latter option, holding it, and I will explain for you why. It was akin to the scene in the M. Night Shyamalan movie Signs, where the wife was pinned by a car against a tree, but she was alive and lucid. This is called crush syndrome, whereby the object that has crushed the victim is actually keeping them alive, and when and if extricated, what is called the smiling death occurs, in which the rapid blood loss causes immediate death. I guess the smiling part is based on the idea that the person crushed is in a really good mood before the moving of the thing crushing them. My car seat was, in this analogy, that object. The pressure I was putting on my ass by pressing it into the car seat was holding in the inevitable shitstorm. So my theory was that I needed the car to not go. I was one with the car now. I just needed to get to Highway 101 and get to the hotel and then rush to the lobby bathroom. It was at least 1:30 a.m., so there were no cars on the road, and I was confident now that I had a plan. The next 15 to 20 minutes were critical. I had to dig deep to work some mind-over-matter techniques. The urge to release was excruciating, but I kept pressing. My left leg pushed as hard as it could against the seat floor of the rental car, putting me into a heavy lean to the right, whereby my left ass cheek was pressing my right with generous force, leaving just enough flexibility to control the gas pedal with my right foot. I was basically semi-slumped, but still driving. I would have steered with my chin, if necessary. Anything to not go. Next, I started chanting. Specifically chanting the word fuck, over and over in different ways, as in sometimes sustained in baritone, and sometimes high-pitched and squealed. It was like an impromptu fuck opera. This got me to the 101, which would take me to the 134 to Pasadena. Chanting full voice now, in essentially a fugue state, and also exhausted by the perpetual flexing of all the 700 or so muscles in my body, I hit the 134, and that was a huge benchmark. Then, I saw the sign for Pasadena, and it was like a puddle of water to a man dying of thirst. Then, it happened. One cannot say who was to blame. I could blame the state of California, or I could blame God. But I hit a huge bump, which set a rapid succession of events in motion. First, it caused me to swerve slightly, which forced me to release my positioning and my clench for just enough time for diarrhea to spew. It was simultaneously horrifying and immensely pleasurable. I knew at once, though, that this was the end of one problem and the beginning of many more. The immediate relief was quickly replaced with two concurrent issues. First, diarrhea in my shorts, and second, the need to have more diarrhea. So at 75 miles per hour, I had to return to the crush syndrome position, but now in a puddle of poo. And there's another thing about diarrhea in a very small enclosed space, the wrenchingly awful odor. I opened the windows and returned to the fuck chanting while in full clench at about 11 miles out from my exit. I remember looking down and laughing maniacally at my choice of wearing shorts, because at least pants would have contained the mess. Also, with seepage, the car seat was getting the runoff. Fucking first class. A flash of winking and doing the finger gun to the flight attendant ran through my mind. Things were so good back then, some 2.5 hours before. Now, I was in a kiddie pool of shit. And the thing about it was, I was so close. I had come so far, just to be derailed by a bump. I finally made it to the exit and had to move into stage 2 of a strategy session with myself. My situation was very delicate. I drove toward the hotel and pulled over in a secluded upscale neighborhood where the resort was. I was about 2 minutes away from it, but I knew I had to do some cleanup before driving in. My plan? Use my t-shirt to wipe up and put on clean clothes, at least getting semi-presentable besides the stench as I drive up. But herein lay the rub, getting up again. The move to the trunk would inevitably cause more problems than it would solve, but I had to change shorts, right? I mean, they were soused. I tried a slow rotation toward the door and knew better. I just had to accept the fact that I had to do this as is. I put the car back in drive and drove the remaining half mile to the hotel. As I approached the gates, I shut off the headlights, like it was a heist. As bad as this was, I still had my dignity and wanted the best possible chance of doing this without drawing extra attention. My goal? To spy if the valet was there so I could pull up without being spotted. Then, I would get as close to the entrance as possible, jump out, grab my bag in the trunk, and hightail to the bathroom inside, hoping to skirt anybody there. It was around 2 a.m., so the hotel, from my vantage point, looked clear of any hotel staff. I went through the mental checklist again just to be certain. Backpack, then trunk, then bathroom. Then gunned the gas and made my move, causing a slight sloshing effect below in the seat. Oh, and by the way, the poor seat. My rental car seat was really in dire shape, being all diarrheaed on and such. I jerked it into park and was reaching for my backpack in the passenger seat when I was startled by the sound of an opening door. The valet, right there, as if he had just materialized. Leaning over, full of shit, with my head craned around meeting eyes with him, I must have looked like a cornered, dying animal. His face showed all, a strange combination of earnest intention, shame, guilt, and hope, along with the strained smile of someone covering up the stark reality that something smells and looks incredibly rotten. Knowing I had no time to waste, I just darted past him with my backpack, leaving the door open, and rushed into the hotel lobby. The lobby was grand in scale and decor, and the registration desk was a good distance to my left. A man emerged behind the desk as I hobbled in at a swift pace, and I just yelled out, "Bathroom!" Barely acknowledging where he pointed, I continued my harried move to salvation. A toilet, toilet paper, and running water. After some aimless rambling, I finally saw the dark wooden door, the finish line, the end of this Old Testament-style punishing journey. Stripped naked in a stall, I spent the next 5 minutes finishing what I had started. And then, a sudden realization hit. I left my bag in the trunk with all my clothes. I spent a long, sad moment staring at the pile of soiled shorts, boxer shorts, and t-shirt on the bathroom floor, knowing I had no options left. I just wanted to die now. Quietly exhale and die on the bathroom floor of the Langham Resort in Pasadena, California. And let the crime scene cleaners come in and just do what they do. After several dozen heavy sighs, I sucked it up and began the grunt work of wiping down the shorts with toilet paper. I put them back on, figuring I would have to get back to my car, grab my keys and get my stuff, run back to the bathroom again and change, and then finally check into my room where I could take a shower. With great discomfort, I redressed in my diarrhea outfit and began frantically cleaning up the scene as best I could, culminating in picking up the boxer shorts to throw them out. When I left the stall, I saw there was no receptacle for garbage, but instead one of those baskets, because in place of paper towels, there was only cloth. After all this, luxury, just like the first-class airline food, once again punched me in the gut with irony, and I was faced with the moral quandary of dumping a shit-soaked pair of boxers in a pile of towels for the cleaning person. Motherfucker, this wouldn't end. Having gone through the entire toilet paper supply, I decided to wrap the boxers in paper toilet seat covers to at least make an effort at mitigating the problem. I ran back and wrapped the boxer shorts like I was swaddling a baby. While doing this, the door to the bathroom opened, and I jerked up to see a large security guard with his hand on a baton. I froze. And then it all became clear. I saw what he was seeing. Not long before, a heavyset, balding middle-aged man had driven at a high rate of speed into the hotel entrance, bounded out of his car, covered in diarrhea, and run into the hotel. And now he found that person, standing in the bathroom, holding a wad of toilet seat covers in his hands. I'm a guest at the hotel. Sure you are. Let me explain, I said. He moved slowly toward me, because what else would anyone do? You need to come with me, he said. What followed was a long, sad walk toward the lobby, the guard keeping me at a healthy distance with his baton, while I tried desperately to explain to him that I was sick and not insane. I even offered up my now shit-soaked license to prove that I was a hotel guest. In the end, I was able to convince him of my story, and I was checked into the hotel by some very kind and smell-tolerant clerks. In the morning, as in about 4 hours later, I met the cast and creators of Archer for the first time, and yawned my way through the event. After the panel, I called for my car, realizing I had never even bothered to check on it. As I waited in the porte cochere, pretentiousness, remember, for the valet to bring it around, I was mortified at the thought that some poor attendant had to drive it even the 100 yards to the lot, given its condition. I mean, I had used my front seat as a diaper. Then, the car pulled up, and an attendant got out smiling.
Mr. Benjamin?
He gestured me in as he hopped out. I slowly poked my head in and took a whiff. Curiously, it smelled fresh and clean. I looked at the seat and saw that it had been scrubbed. Whoever had parked the car the night before had steam-cleaned my seat. It was like nothing had ever happened. I asked the valet if he knew anything about this strange person who had done this, and he had no idea.
Seriously, do you know who worked last night? Because I had diarrhea in this seat, and now it's all gone.
He gave me a smile that read, I hate all the guests here. I guess he took it as a joke, and in many ways it was. Anyway, it was a true first-class miracle. I handed the valet a $5 tip. I'm not a millionaire, and he didn't clean it, and drove away. If you're out there, man who cleaned my diarrhea rental car, thank you. Chapter 22. How I failed at differentiating my two characters of Bob and Archer. I did the same voice. The end. Epilogue. My failure is an option. Imagine the feeling of accomplishment after training so long and running and finishing a full marathon. You'd remember that moment forever and feel proud that you were able to do what you set out to do. But what if you did the same extensive training, began the marathon, got separated from the pack, got disoriented, turned around, and ran the wrong way for miles, only to find yourself back at the starting line? That's a way better story than finishing a marathon. Not to mention, you probably ran like 13 miles in that story. That's a lot. When I die, I will probably be remembered as something of a success. My obituary will list my accomplishments, the family I left behind, and most likely string together some kind words about my career. Nothing about my shortcomings. Only I am privy to the map that outlines my life the way I drew it. A cartographic collage with rivers of misgivings and shame, oceans of mismanaged emotions and finances, archipelagos of overeating, and mountains of self-doubt and petty grievances. It won't speak eloquently of my penis envy. I have often stated that what I lack in penis size, I make up for in penis envy. It won't share with the world my unhealthy habit of being perpetually boorish and intellectually unsound. It will specifically omit my predilection for smelling my own feces on toilet paper after I wipe. It will also fail to mention my very frequent and unyielding insistence on being boring while drunk. It won't even hint at that time I drunkenly ordered what I thought was a prostitute on a website, only to find out she was a licensed masseuse. All that scented oil wasted on miscommunication. And it certainly won't reveal that after registering to vote for the first time in 1984, I voted for the Republican Ray Shamey for Senate over John Kerry, just because I liked his slogan, "You can call me Ray." But isn't this a fate that most of us share? So much of my life has been a succession of small personal failures, and still, I will be remembered for the good fortune. Isn't the life squandered the real story of mankind once you take away the will to survive? Walt Whitman wrote, "I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass." I lean and loaf all the time. And yet, we don't celebrate the loafing and the leaning. This is the spirit in which I told you my tales. The scope of my indifference fills the air with the fetid stench of the failed spirits who came before me. Look at Whitman's words in this light, in the disquieting light of the freedom to fail. During the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, people of my faith fast for 24 hours, and on the night of the fast, they go to synagogue and pray to God to be absolved for the sins they committed that calendar year. Everyone stands and repeats the litany of sins that we ask God to forgive. The list is endless, so many sins. And every year, We beseech God to hear our plaintive cries for mercy because in our hearts, we are failing all the time in so many ways. Here's a couple of highlights. For the sin which we have committed by frivolity, for the sin which we have committed by obduracy, for the sin which we have committed in passing judgment, for the sin which we have committed by causeless hatred, for the sin which we have committed by running to do evil, for the sin which we have committed by hard-heartedness, for the sin which we have committed by a gathering of lewdness, for the sin which we have committed by foolish talk, for the sin which we have committed by a haughty demeanor, for the sin which we have committed by casting off the yoke, for the sin which we have committed by a confused heart, for the sin for which we incur the penalty of 40 lashes, for the sins for which we are obligated to bring a burnt offering, and so many more. So, what are we to make of all this? I can tell you that I have reached one very obvious conclusion. Every sin listed, each and every one, would make an excellent band name. Come on, tell me Casting Off the Yoke is not a really good band name. And 40 Lashes? Fucking gold. And don't tell me some prog rock kid wouldn't want his first band to be called Obduracy. All kids who are starting a band, seriously, check out the full list in the Jewish High Holiday Prayer Book. In the end, and I hate to get all preachy, but failure is an option in a verifiable way. So many out there place an undue burden on themselves to succeed at something, whatever it might be. And then, if they fail, grow seeds of resentment and hate towards that failure, and as a result, themselves, and in many cases, project that resentment and hatred onto others. The key to failure being an option is a way forward. Failing at something is a signal, but it's not a signifier. It doesn't mean the end of something. Often, it's a springboard toward something better, or worse, but isolating a failure and fueling it with too much pressure to reverse it is never a good path. With this, I will say, I hope you fail well. The end. Oh, shit, I realize I wanted to give you a more helpful means to fail and provide you the practical guidance you need. How can a book about my failures help you withstand your failures? What did we all learn beyond beware of those compelled to succeed? How in the world does this end again? I guess it must end with my imparting to you a crucial lesson, a lesson that could forever alter the course of your life, a lesson that is simple enough to absorb, and one that, if you are suffering, can pull you from doldrums and lead you to a softer place, a lesson that, as told, could prepare you to never fail again, a lesson that, simply put, could have been written far earlier in this book, so to save you all this trouble. But, forget it. The end, too. Sorry about that. Anyway, this is still H. John Benjamin. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Failure is an Option, an Attempted Memoir. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Kelly Gilday, recorded by Alan Tobin at CDM Studios in New York City. Text copyright 2018 by Hassenpfeff Incorporated. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.